Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on lies my teacher told me when we come back. Hey, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools and banned from our public institutions. They're banned from our national consciousness. Now, instead of these 10 simple, time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, in our public institutions, and now we've made them a part of our national psyche. And this is a very radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Now, are you aware, for instance, your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but she can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. And let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. Our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments, and they even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. Now, there's at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, commandments, and penalties, as well as the 33 benefits that we receive for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effects. So whether we call this the Mosaic Law or the Law of God or the Common Law or Natural Law or Karma or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happen to be the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we were talking about this thing of lies my teacher told me, and I broke in and I said, let me show you another article here written by a fellow by the name of Schoen, S-C-H-O-O-N. He entitled it, The Killers Are With the Patient, talking about the economy and this bailout program here. Now, the killers are with the patient. The very people who created the credit crisis to start with are the people that are going to prescribe to you the cure, if you can believe that. And it's not something new. It's been going on for thousands of years. The bankers and the politicians teaming up together have been fleecing the taxpayers at least since the time of Moses. Moses didn't do it. That was the one time that we got out from under the banker's thumb. There have been a few times in history when we, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives of the world, got out from under the banker's thumb, but it's been rare. Andrew Jackson did it the last time. Just before that, about 30 or 40 years, the Constitutional Convention did it. In 1787, the writers, or the framers of our Constitution, a guy by the name of George Mason, spearheaded the attack, wrote 17 words into our federal Constitution called, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender payment of debt." And then about 6-7 years later, they created a national bank called the U.S. National Bank and renewed its charter in 1816. And then when the charter came up for renewal in 1836, Andrew Jackson vetoed it. The Congress passed it. The Congress is going to pass this bailout, and this time the president's going to sign it. The chance that we had would have been with Ron Paul, who, if he had been president, would probably do something about this national bank, you know, if he could. But this deal is going to be done before the next president takes over. That's assuming there's going to be a next president. You know, that's yet to be seen. But the moral to the story is that the people who caused this financial crisis, this meltdown, this paper money, starting in 1913 with our Federal Reserve, are now in control of the Congress and the executive branch, and they're going to write the laws that are going to solve your problem for you, which in reality is going to exacerbate your problem and put you into hyperinflation, a Great Depression, take all of your property and money away from you, destroy you financially, and then they're going to give you a new currency, I think it's called the Amero, and then we can start this game over again so that they can rob you again. And then when that one collapses, and they'll give you new color paper money, and they'll do it to you again and again and again. We haven't learned anything in this process over the last 5,000 years, and I doubt very seriously that we're going to learn anything this round, but I thought I'd report it to you anyway. And so Daryl Schoen, if you want a copy of the article, it's Daryl Schoen, D-R Schoen, just drschoon.com. We'll get you on his website, or you can go to Kitco, K-I-T-C-O, kitco.com. And you're looking for the article by Daryl Schoen, And the article is dated 9/24/08. 9/24/08 is the date, and the title is "The Chillers Are With the Patient." Now, as autumn approaches, this summer's credit crisis continues to spread through the global grid created by today's financial wizards. And these wizards, so adept, they do not understand what it is that they've set in motion. This summer's credit crisis surprised them. And the most is the most disturbing thing of all. We surprised. What do you mean? You mean to tell me that Ben Bernanke is surprised? Henry Paulson is surprised? Well, that's what Shun says. He says they're surprised. And then here's the most disturbing news of all. The financial wizards of Wall Street and the inner city of London are hoping that this summer's credit crisis is a bad cold at worst, and that perhaps a slight fever, and time will heal the illness and they can return once again to the task of carving out billion-dollar bonuses from capitalism's rotting carcass. But the wizards of Wall Street and the city will be wrong this fall. This summer's credit contraction looks increasingly less like a cold and more like cancer or pneumonia, a cancer which has metastasized and made its way into the lymph nodes of our global economy. This credit contraction of August 2007 wasn't a cold, it was cancer, and since then it has spread with increasing rapidity throughout the U.S. and global economies. And now, 1 year later, the ignorant, the unknown, the desperate, led by the deceitful, the selfish, and the clever, are hoping that this is only pneumonia. It's China that is keeping the patient alive. And some are alleging that the U.S. government's accelerating bailout of banks, insurance companies, is socialism. And although it is government intervention in extreme, such intervention in the markets does not constitute socialism. This bailout of investment banks and corporations by the U.S. government is fascism. The control and intervention of government by corporate interests designed to further corporate and state control, this multi-trillion dollar state support of J.P. Morgan, AIG, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac, and now perhaps soon GM, Ford, and Chrysler, is fascism. Write that word down, fascism. That's not socialism. And fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is the merger of the state and corporate power. So what we're watching now before our eyeballs is the merger of state and corporate power, which is the prelude to this New World Order program. What we're watching is an orchestrated program which has an agenda and which has an outcome. And we were all told, you know, years and years ago not to participate in this outcome. That was Moses told us, don't do that. Don't participate in unjust weights and balances, this paper money program. Don't participate in usury and interest. But, you know, we're adults. We all went to college, you know. Now we've got degrees after our names, and so now we're smarter than God, and so we went out here to cut a fat hog in the back. Now let's take a look and see how this fat hog looks when we get him butchered. Now, Benito Mussolini was the fascist dictator of Italy from 1922 to 1943. And here's what he said. He said, fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's the merger of state and corporate power. That's Benito Mussolini. That's exactly what we're doing here today in America. We're moving away now from what we used to call capitalism. Now we're going to move into a new program here. It's called fascism. Now, what is ironic is that our arch enemy, China, a self-described socialist state, is increasingly now responsible for the well-being of the United States, a nation rapidly transforming itself into a fascist nation right before our eyes. And while this might be the ultimate resolution of the two competing ideologies of the 20th century, I don't think so. And instead, it could be the end of both. Now, China is the originator of paper money. Paper, along with paper money, was first invented in China. And Ralph T. Foster's book, Fiat Paper Money, The History and Evolution of Our Currency, states that on January 12, 1024 AD, the Sung Court directed the Imperial Treasury to issue national paper money for general use. Okay, write that number down, boys and girls, that date. That's January 12, 1024. There's the first recorded paper money in the modern era. Now, up until then, we were using coin to cheat people, what they used to do back in the Roman days, you know, and the Babylonians and Assyrians and so on. Before they knew about paper money, instead they created fiat money, but they did it with clad coins, like our president, Lyndon Johnson, did back in 1965. What they do is they take the gold coins and they put a little something more in them, and then they tell you, well, that's to make it circulating, make it harder. So you take a gold coin and you mix it with 10% copper. And that way you can cheat people out of 10%. And then, like you Canadians up there, so you've got silver in your money, the old silver money you used to have. But you Canadians were a little greedier than we Americans, and so you put 80% in. So Canadian coins, the old Canadian coins, were 80% silver and 20% copper. The American coins were 90% silver and 10% copper. So you Canadians up there, bigger thieves than we are. And then as time progresses along, like Lyndon Johnson, they just take all of the silver out of it and give you the slugs called clad coinage, which is what we've had since 1965. And that's the way they did it in the old days. So the Chinese now are the inventors of what we call paper currency. And they did it, get the date now, January 12th, 1024 AD. 2 centuries later, the Sun Dynasty's paper money had lost almost all of its value due to overprinting. Later attempts were made to resuscitate paper money, but all such attempts were, in the end, it led to failure and economic collapse. And Foster sums up China's experiment with paper money as follows. He said, over the course of 600 years, five dynasties had implemented paper money, and all five made frequent use of the printing press to solve problems. Economic catastrophe and political chaos inevitably followed. Time and time again, officials looked to paper money for instant liquidity and the immediate transfer of wealth, but its ostensible virtues could not withstand its tragic legacy. Those who had it as a store of value found that in time, all they had were worthless pieces of paper. Okay, now that was the outcome of the six experiments in China with paper money beginning in 1024 through the 16th century. Now, Marco Polo came back. Remember Marco Polo? And that's where he saw paper money used. And he brought it back to Europe and said, my God, look at what they're doing over here. Well, now, the paper money makes money for government, makes money for bankers. It makes money for the people that are issuing the stuff and passing it around. And it doesn't make money for the people that actually use it out on Main Street. Now, it looks good, smells good, feels good. Everybody tells you that it's good, but the ultimate end of it is the loss of about 90% of your wealth. That's what happened from 1754 until 1783 here in the colonies. And the average loss was 90%. Now, the ultimate end of this, as we look back to 1930, and we measure from 1930 to 2008 or 10, so far we have lost 98%. See, we lost 98% of our purchasing power compared to 1930. So the demise of the dollar has occurred in just one lifetime. Now that's here in the United States. And this is going to take everybody in the world down with them, because the Chinese are sitting over there with $1 trillion worth of U.S. dollars, and the Japanese about the same, and the Russians $500 billion. I mean, we got this money spread all over the world. And all of these nations are going to take it in the shorts. They're going to lose their purchasing power, going to lose their money, which means they worked for nothing. And the ultimate outcome of this, every time this happens, war is the result. And now, when the Americans stiff everybody around the world, you can just about bet war will be the result. Now, this time, we're going to stiff the Russians and the Chinese for about $1.5 trillion. That should trigger World War III. That should get us involved in nuclear war. And Bible prophecy tells us that we're going to have nuclear war three times in the Bible. We're going to have nuclear war. And the book of Revelation kind of describes it pretty vividly. It doesn't call it nuclear war. They didn't have that word in their vocabulary. But if it's talking about wars that will destroy whole cities. My God, you know, until World War II in Hiroshima and Nagasaki with those A-bombs, you know, that hasn't been possible now in our world, but it is now. And I think that we're right on the cusp. Now, Fiat Paper Money, The History and Evolution of Our Planet by Ralph T. Foster, second edition, 2008, on page 29. It's available by email. And you can call 520 if you want a telephone number. It's 520-845-3015. The History and Evolution of Our Currency, Ralph T. Foster, second edition, 2008. And this story comes from page 29. And if you'll call, it's available by email. So you can call in, probably give them your credit card number, and they'll send it to you over your email. The telephone number again is 520-845-3015. Now, in 1661, China formally outlawed the use of paper money, and it wasn't to reappear in China until the 1800s, when the English traders wanted to pay for Chinese goods with paper bank notes issued by the Bank of England. Now, the Bank of England claimed that its paper money was backed by gold, and therefore it was as good as gold. Now, the Chinese, suspicious of Western ways, and rightfully so, demanded instead to be paid in their circulating currency. They wanted silver. And as the British badly wanted China's porcelains, teas, and silks, this forced the British to buy silver on the open market in order to purchase goods from China. I might point out that in 1875, we made in this country what we called the trade dollar. So if you look back in our history, you'll see a thing here called the trade dollar, which was made specifically for international trade and with specificity the Chinese trade. Now, if the British banknotes were de facto fully backed by gold, as claimed by the Bank of England, there would have been little need for England to go to war in order to instead force China to accept British opium. But the British claim of 100% convertibility to gold was more a public relations gesture than an actual reality, at least in the large amounts demanded by the growing China trade. Now, buyers always prefer payment with paper money. So when you're buying something, you don't want to give these people gold. You want to buy it with your paper money. But the sellers always prefer payment with gold or silver. We actually prefer getting paid with something that's worth something. So remember that the buyers, the corporations, they want to pay you your wages with a check, with paper money. They don't want to pay you with a car. They don't want to pay you with the goods that they're producing. They don't want to pay you with gold or silver. They want to pay you with paper. That's why here in America, most Americans have never been paid in their lifetimes. They've been discharged, never paid, always discharged. The subjugation of China, the first by England and the West and then by Japan, continued until the Chinese communists forced out the Japanese, who had previously forced out the Russians and the British. Now, but in the intervening years between the British invasion in the 1840s and the Chinese communist victory one century later, the Bank of England, with the aid of the U.S. Federal Reserve, had instituted the universal acceptance of central bank-issued paper money everywhere in the world, and China was no exception. Wikipedia recounts the long experience of China with paper money and hyperinflation. And so we go to Wikipedia, that's an online encyclopedia, which tells us that as the first user of fiat currency, China has had an early history of troubles caused by hyperinflation. The Yuan dynasty from 1271 to 1368 printed huge amounts of fiat paper money to fund their wars, and the resulting hyperinflation coupled with other factors led to its demise at the hands of a revolution. The Republic of China went through the worst inflation in 1948 and 49. In 1947, the highest denomination was 50,000 yuan. By mid-1948, the highest denomination was 180 million yuan. The 1948 currency reform replaced the yuan by the gold yuan at an exchange rate of one gold yuan for 3 million yuan. In less than a year, the highest denomination was 10 million gold yuan. That shows you how much it was backed by gold. The highest denomination by a regional bank was 6 billion yuan, issued by the Xinjiang Provincial Bank in 1949, after the renminbi was instituted by the new communist government. Hyperinflation ceased with a revaluation of 1 to 10,000 in 1955. Now, although China first outlawed the use of paper money in the 17th century, it now possesses over $1 trillion worth of fiat paper money here in the 21st century, the majority of it in the form of recently issued U.S. paper dollars. Now the problems of hyperinflation may soon again affect China, because if the U.S. continues to print its way out of increasing problems, hyperinflation of the U.S. dollar will destroy the value of China's monetary reserves. So let's stop here for a moment and think about that. If you take a look at the total amount of money that we Americans have printed, it's in the neighborhood of 9 to 13 trillion. Now, I don't know exactly what that number is. I've looked it up recently, but as recently as 2004, we had $9 trillion in circulation. It was M1, M2, and M3. And Alan Greenspan announced that their goal, that what they were looking forward to, was issuing $13 trillion worth of paper. All right, now, if you've got $9 trillion worth of paper and you issue $4 trillion more, $4.5 trillion, would have the value of the $9 trillion that's in circulation in 2004. So if you want to make your money worth half as much, if you want to devalue it by 50%, just double the amount of money in circulation. Now, the first guy to issue this money gets 100 cents value on the dollar when he goes into Walmart and buys a jar of mayonnaise. But as this money circulates through the economy, it bids prices up. And the ultimate end of that is that it empties the shelves. It's called hyperinflation, and the shelves become bare. That's what you see today with hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. Now, hyperinflation can set in as little as 3 days. That's the experience of the Brazilians, who went from about 25 or 30% inflation to 5,000% inflation in 3 days. It also happened in Israel. So if you don't think it can happen here, remember it's already been done. I'm just reporting historical facts. We human beings have always reacted and always acted in predictable ways. So people are calling me and they're asking me, well, do you think that the Congress is going to pass this bailout bill? Well, here's my answer. Every single experience in the past, the answer is yes, they have in the past. And right now today, everybody in the news media, everybody in the Congress is calling for this bailout program, even though the latest poll I saw showed 65% of Americans are opposed to it and 35% don't know. So there's a great groundswell of public opposition to being buried in all of this debt, and it's been rightly so. I'd be opposed to it too. So there's little reason to believe that in the future, that is right now, that the Congress isn't going to do it. And the president says he's going to sign it. He's the one that's asking for it. So we're not going to be saved by a Ron Paul. We're not going to be saved by an Andrew Jackson. We're not going to be saved by a Continental Congress that's going to write in a gold clause into our Constitution. Hell, we've already got all of that and threw it away and went to paper money. So my answer is, yes, you can bet that the Congress is going to approve the bailout program and that you're going to be saddled with the debt, that is, all of you taxpayers. Now, of course, there's a solution to that. You could withdraw from the tax system. You could empty your bank account from the bank. You could resign your Social Security account number And then you could go back to practicing the Ten Commandments, and with specificity, thou shalt not steal, on the statute that supports it, which says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. I mean, those are some concrete steps that you could take to sidestep to get out of the way of the oncoming train. It's not likely that very many people are going to do that, but it's a thought, you know, in case you decided that you didn't want to underwrite the Bernanke helicopter, Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson program, to saddle you with all of these wonderful investments that they made and now are in default, and they're going to sell them to you. My God, do you think that's good investment strategy, to go out and buy the proven bad debts? I mean, we're not just buying stock that we think is worth a dollar. We're going out here now in this bailout program, and we're going to buy paper, mortgages, and SIVs, and default swaps, and other forms of commercial paper that we know are only worth 5 cents, 10 cents, or 20 cents on the dollar, absolutely proven to be worth near nothing. And we're going to pay 100 cents on the dollar for it. And these guys, they've got a lot of gonads to come to you and make such a proposal. I mean, I couldn't even make a proposal like that. It is so preposterous. But hell, they've not only made it, they're debating it in the Congress. I mean, these congressmen over here are actually talking about it, talking it up, trying to sell it. The president came on television the other night, and he said, hey, this is a necessary step. We have to do this. Can you believe it? I mean, that takes chutzpah, you know, when you talk about it in the Jewish vernacular. Now, although China has a much longer history than the United States, both of the world's oldest civilizations, China, and the relative newcomer, the United States, will face a dangerous economic future if the United States continues to accelerate the growth of its money supply. But no one can control the United States in this regard, not even the United States. So we're going to continue to print more money, of which I just mentioned, I think that the number is around $13 trillion. That was I know it's $9 trillion plus. Now, I think it may be as high as $13 trillion. Now, they're inflating at the rate of 15% a year right now. Last numbers I saw from the International Forecaster, the M3, which is no longer published now by the Treasury, but we can calculate M3. So it isn't that M3 isn't out there. We know what the M3 is. It's 15%, which in 2009 is programmed to go to 20%. They're going to inflate the currency by 20% a year. So in 5 years, they ought to be able to double it, be less than 5 years, from 13 to 26 trillion or from 9 to 18 trillion. Now, when you double the amount of money you put into circulation, you know, then you cut the value of your money in half, don't you? And that's what it looks like to me. So they inflated the currency from 2000 to 2004. I think, well, it was from 1987. There was 3 trillion in circulation in 87, and by 2000, they had 9 trillion in circulation, and then by about 2004, I think was the year, or thereabouts, 2003, right after the Iraq war got cooking, they needed more money. So they said, well, we're going to print it. We're just going to print more money. They said, our target now is $13 trillion. That was when they were still telling us about M3. Now, I don't know exactly where these numbers are, but you can see that they're bigger than taking your shoes off. I mean, by the time we get our hands and feet and our hands, you know, our fingers and our toes out here, you know, it takes a lot of doing to count up to a trillion. So you're going to have something more than just, you know, your hand, fingers and your feet here to count on. That's a lot of money. And we're going into hyperinflation. I mean, hell, anybody can see that. And now they're coming along saying, well, we want to bail all of these banks out so that they'll lend you money. Huh? Sounds like extortion to me. Doesn't that sound like, let's see, we need to bail the banks out and take up all of their bad debts so that they'll lend us money, keep the economy going. Excuse me. Doesn't that sound like Ronnie Mitchell saying, if you don't play nice with me, you can't play in my sandbox? If you don't do what I tell you, you can't play in my sandbox. If you don't bail us out with our bad debts, we're not going to lend you any more money. Hell, these people never had any money to lend us to start with. They were lending us credit and charging us usury for it and taking our labor and payment. And then you thought that was a good deal. Now they want you to buy up all their toxic waste and pledge your house or what equity you got left in your house as collateral for it, huh? They want to put you on the hook and your children and your children's children. In other words, what this proposal is, it will make you American taxpayers credit debt serfs for the rest of your life and probably all the lives of your children for generations to come. Now, that's the proposal. You've always bought it in the past. You've always been credit debt serfs in the past. No reason why you shouldn't return to your roots now, is it? Now, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And that's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these law hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the law hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. And once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the law hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about Lies My Teacher Told Me. Now, that's a book written by James W. Loewen, L-O-E-W-E-N. James Loewen, Lies My Teacher Told Me. There's a second book over here that would be good for you. It's called The America, To Pray or Not to Pray, written by David Barton. I'll give you his name and number here in a minute, but listen to this. Here's some basic subject knowledge that's lacking in our history courses. You see, we should be teaching our children economic and financial history. You know, if we went back and said, okay, now here's why we Americans use gold and silver coin, boys and girls. It's because the Chinese tried paper money, and it failed them 5 or 6 times in 600 years. And we tried paper money in the colonies, and it failed us twice. And the paper money caused a Great Depression in the 1930s, and we should learn from history. See, that's what we should be teaching our children, but we don't. We haven't, and we're not very likely to in the future. And as a result of that, here in the United States, students going to our public schools are abysmally ignorant as to money, coin, currency, and indeed history in general. And David Barton points that out on page 73. He says, an environment where violence, disrespect, and immorality prevails is not conductive or conducive to learning. There have been such declines in students' knowledge of basic academic facts that on March 17, 1986, U.S. Senator Bill Bradley moved to designate a Geography Awareness Week. A survey taken in January of that year, which had examined 5,000 high school seniors from 8 major cities on their knowledge of basic geography, had precipitated this move. Now here's the results. 25% of the students tested in Dallas, Texas could not identify the country that borders the United States on the south. That's Mexico. Huh? Wait a minute. Texas is one of the states that borders Mexico on the south. I mean, you know, if you're living in North Dakota and we ask a North Dakotan what country borders the United States on the south, and the kids from North Dakota, maybe you could say, well, he doesn't know that. But, I mean, come on, Dallas, Texas, you people are bordered by that country. Well, 1/4 of your students tested in 1986 couldn't tell you that. They didn't know. 39% of the students in Boston couldn't name the 6 New England states. Huh? Up in Boston, one of the 6 New England states. You ask these people in New England, can you name the 6 New England states? And they go, huh? 40% couldn't. 45% of those tested in Baltimore could not respond correctly to this instruction. On the attached map, shade in the area where the United States is located. Did you catch that number? This is Baltimore. 45%, that's nearly 50%, 1 out of every 2, when shown a map of the United States, a map of the world, and then asked to shade in the area of the world where the United States is located, half the people, half of the high school seniors in Baltimore, Maryland, could not find the United States on a map. I mean, come on, wake up here. Similar geographic weaknesses were discovered in a survey of college students conducted by the University of North Carolina in 1984. Now, here's college students. When asked to identify the 2 largest states, fewer than half of them could name Texas and Alaska. So you go to a college kid and you say, can you identify the 2 largest states in the United States, Texas and Alaska? And less than half of them could do that. Almost 80% couldn't name the 2 smallest states. That would be Rhode Island and Delaware. You know, just basic geography here. You know, hell, I knew that when I was a kid going to school. He's teaching that in about the 3rd, 4th, 5th grade, somewhere along that. Bradley concluded, this news is frightening. We depend on a well-informed populace to maintain the democratic ideals which have made our country great. When 95% of some of our brightest college students cannot locate Vietnam on a world map, we must sound the alarm. We cannot expect to be a world leader if our populace doesn't even know who the rest of the world is. 95% of Americans can't find Vietnam on a world map. And so that leads me to believe that most of you people out there couldn't find Afghanistan, Iran, or Iraq on a world map either. Now, basic historical knowledge appears to be at the same substandard level as basic geographical knowledge. A 1988 Department of Education book entitled American Education, Making It Work, concluded, many students are unaware of prominent people and seminal ideas and events that have shaped our past and created our present. Now, that statement resulted from a 1986 assessment of 17-year-old students, 80% of whom were enrolled in U.S. history classes at the time of the test. Now, here are some of the problem areas. All right, now let's take a look at this. 17-year-old students, seniors in high school, across the nation are tested by the Department of Education. We're going to find out what their historical knowledge is like. All right, now listen to this. Almost half could not place World War I between 1900 and 1950. So 50% of the high school students, not college, not high school students, half of them couldn't identify the time period for the First World War. More than two-thirds did not know when the Civil War took place. And that was from 1861 to 1865, for all of you out there that don't know. That's two-thirds. That's 66% could not tell you when the Civil War took place here in the United States. More than 75% were unable to say within 20 years as to when Abraham Lincoln was president. That was during the Civil War, 1861 to 1865. But 75%, that's 3 out of 4, couldn't tell you. One-fifth, that's 20% of the students, could not identify George Washington as the commander of the colonial forces during the Revolution. We're getting better. That's only 20 out of 100, one-fifth. One-third, that's 33%. Now, one-third did not know that Lincoln was the author of the Emancipation Proclamation. Emancipation Proclamation, Abraham Lincoln, 1862, 1863. One-half failed to recognize Patrick Henry as the man who said, give me liberty or give me death. One-third did not know that the Declaration of Independence signaled the American colonists' break from England. And almost half could not say approximately when the Constitution was written. And that was in 1787, in case you didn't know. Now, American academic weaknesses become even more glaring when American students are compared with their peers in other countries. In 1983, the Dallas Times-Herald asked 4 educational experts to develop a test covering math, science, and geography, which was given to 12-year-old students in 8 nations. The results of that international testing are shown on the following page, and the United States did very poorly. The United States comes in last in math, comes in 6th in science, and 4th in geography when tested around the world. And remember, we're the people that spend $10,800 per student educating our children in our public schools. We spend more than anybody else in the world, and we've got just about the dumbest kids that money can buy. Now, this translates then into political power, because when these kids turn 18, they all turn into voters. And so we're talking about the 1980s, how all those people are out here in the marketplace voting for President of the United States now in 2008. These are the people who couldn't find the United States of America on a world map, don't know where Vietnam is located, and they're voting for President of the United States. Now, and a very interesting thing occurred here. Salmon P. Chase made an observation. Salmon P. Chase was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but he was also the Secretary of the Treasury in 1862. And it was in 1862 that Salmon P. Chase was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he was a part of the Lincoln administration when they adopted paper money to finance and pay for the Civil War. And here's what Mr. Chase said. He said, my agency in promoting the passage of the National Banking Act was the greatest financial mistake of my life. It has built up a monopoly which affects every interest in the country. It should be repealed. But before that can be accomplished, the people will be arrayed on one side and the banks on the other side in a contest such as we have never seen before in this country. Now, I'd like to weigh in on that. I don't believe that's true. I do not believe that the people of America are going to line up on one side and the banks on the other side in this great predicted contest. I think that the people of America are going to be led right down the primrose path. And even though 65% of you are opposed to this bailout, you're going to be given the bailout, and you're going to be saddled with the debts, and you're going to sit down and shut up and do what you're told. Now, that's what I think is going to happen. If you think you're going to rescue the economy, which I think we could do, we did it in 1787. I mean, we were in the depths of a depression. And the Congress woke up and they said, hey, let's abolish paper money and go back to gold and silver. And 3 years later, in 1791, 3 or 4 years later, George Washington wrote a letter to a friend of his. And I forgot who he wrote it to now or where I saw this. You know, I know somebody's going to write me a letter now and say, hey, what's the citation there? Maybe you could look that up yourself. But George Washington said, I can't believe the immensity of the economic turnaround that has occurred in just the last 36 months, 3 years, by going back to gold and silver. Now, boys and girls, you're going to have a depression, whether you like it or not. It's coming. Then you're not going to bail it out. But if you would let the banks and all of the sovereign wealth funds and everybody else around the world that's been playing with this paper money, if you'd let them take those losses, they made them, let them eat them, and go back to gold and silver coin, in about 36 months, you'd probably do about the same thing that we did in 1787. I don't think you're going to do that. I don't think your president's going to do that. I don't think your new president, if you have one, is going to do that. I know George Bush isn't. I know the Congress isn't, but not this Congress. So I think that Salmon P. Chase, who recognized that his agency had made this big mistake, you know, I don't think it's going to be corrected. Thomas Jefferson made this observation. He said, I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. He says, already, they have raised up a money aristocracy that has set the government at defiance. The issuing power of money should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it belongs. Congress gave that power to create money to the Federal Reserve. That's a private bank back in 1913. It should be taken away from them and restored to the Congress where it belongs. That isn't going to happen. Barack Obama's not going to do that. John McCain's not going to do that. You're not going to get any change there. Jefferson made another observation. He said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, then first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. All right, boys and girls, that's what the housing crisis is all about. You people are going to wake up homeless on the continent that your fathers conquered because you allowed the private banks and the corporations that grew up around them, the people that you're now going to bail out and take all of their bad debts that are worth 5 cents on the dollar, you're going to pay them 100 cents on the dollar. You're going to create a hyperinflation which is going to destroy you. Well, you've always done it in the past. What in the hell makes you think you're going to do any different this time? I mean, you people out there that can't even find the United States of America on a world map. You know, if you're that ignorant, what in the hell makes you think that you're going to solve your financial problem? To give you another example here, in Leviticus 25, verses 36 and 37, it says, take you no usury of him or increase, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. You shall not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him any victuals for increase. There's a statutory provision given to us by our God, and he said, don't practice interest. All right, now all you people out there with mortgages on your houses, huh? You're making your mortgage payment paying interest every month, aren't you? Now, you were told, don't do that. But, you know, hell, you're smarter than God. And so now you have awakened on the continent that your fathers conquered, homeless, as they repossess your home. Huh? I didn't make it that way. I'm just a reporter here telling you that that's the way this deal came down. Now, John Adams made an observation back in 1787. He said, all of the perplexities, all of the confusion and distress in America arise not from the defects in our Constitution or Confederation, not from the want of honor or virtue, so much as from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. Henry Ford said, the greatest thing in life is experience. Even our mistakes have value for us. Now take the matter of money, for example. There's no doubt that financiers have failed to do their best to give us an efficient money system. And yet, it was their principal business to do just that. The function of money is not to make money, but to move goods. Money is only one part of our transportation system. It moves goods from man to man. A dollar bill is like a postage stamp. It's no good unless it'll move commodities between persons. If a postage stamp will not carry a letter or money will not move goods, it is just the same as an engine that will not run. And someone will have to get out and fix it. And that's where you're at with your credit crisis. You see, you got your money that's not moving goods and services. It's locked up. Like a postage stamp that's been stamped cancel, won't deliver the letter. Now, there's a fella in here, I got to tell you. His name is Josiah Stamp. And this guy, Stamp, was a banker with the Bank of England. And he said, banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the world. Take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money. And with the flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it all back again. Now, take this great power away from the bankers, and all great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, because this would then be a better world than a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be slaves of the bankers and to pay the cost of your own slavery, then let them continue to create your money. Josiah Stamp, a banker, 1920, made that observation. He was with the Bank of England. Nothing's changed. It doesn't make any difference if the guy is English or Russian, or he's an American or Canadian or Australian, or he's a Chinese or Japanese. Bankers around the world are ripping off everybody in the world. It's been going on for thousands of years. It's going on today in front of your eyeballs, and it will continue to go on as long as man is in control of his own government. And that's because he's ignorant. Now, if you want to see how ignorant he is, this America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. God, what a book. It's a small book, you know, paperback. I think it's 12 bucks. 150 pages or so, called America to Pray or Not to Pray, a statistical look at what happened when religious principles were separated from public affairs. It's written by David Barton. Here's his name and address. David Barton is with Wall Builder Press, P.O. Box 397 in Aledo, Texas, A-L-E-D-O, Texas, 76008. Now, he's got a phone number here. The number is 817-441-4444. 617-441-6044. Again, that's 817-441-6044, called America to Pray or Not to Pray. I think you hit the nail right on the head. Now, if you're one of those people out there says, well, I'd like to solve this problem for me, for my family. Hell, there's a solution out there for you and your family. You know, as individuals, we can solve the problem. I'm not going to write a letter to Kit Bond and say, Kit, do not vote for this bailout. What do I care? You know, if the people of America, the taxpayers of America, of which I'm not one of them, want to continue with this paper fiat currency, well, you certainly have a right to do that. Why should I get in here and tell you people not to participate in this? It's bad for you. Hell, you're an adult. You ought to be able to figure that out for yourself. My conclusion is it's bad for George Gordon, so I'm not going to participate in it. And if you'd like to get out of it, then that's what our school is all about. We're here to show people, here's how you disengaged from this lunacy, from this insanity. Here's the way to start off by practicing the Ten Commandments. You know, we got two models here. You got the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto model, which calls for a central bank, plank 5, free education for all children in public school, plank 10, and a heavy progressive income tax, plank 2. That's what you people are all practicing. And it is leading you to financial destruction, just like it has led all communists to financial destruction in the past. The opposite to that is called the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandment model. It says, thou shalt not steal. You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. You shall not make a contract with these foreign and alien gods, like the United States and Canada and Australia. But you know, we go to college and we get letters after our names and we get to be real smart people. And then we kind of smile superciliously and say, well, now that gold is a barbaric relic. And these people are not in tune with modern finance and economics. And you're right, I'm not. I'm going to get as far away from it as I can, while I still can. Hey, I'm out of time again here, children. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.